Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover. I just want to thank you all for coming, and thank you for your support of Tattered Cover, and thank you for supporting our touring authors. We are just thrilled tonight to have Chris Cleave here with his book, just released in paperback, Little Bee. Chris Cleave is a popular columnist for The Guardian newspaper in London, and he has received numerous awards for his first novel, Incendiary, which we also have right up here on the shelf. Chris has worked as a bartender, a long-distance sailor, a teacher of navigation, marine navigation, and as an internet pioneer. Both of his novels we are going to be lucky to soon see in the future in movies. And in fact, Nicole Kidman just purchased and will produce and star in Little Bee. And I have to say, I was looking up some things about Chris Cleave, and I was so excited because I thought, oh, he has another book coming, and it's already out in England, and oh, we'll probably get it in a year or so, and it's called The Other Hand. And then I read a little more, and it's like, that's what they call Little Bee in England. It's got the title there is The Other Hand, so it's not the new book coming here. But will you all please help me welcome Chris Cleave?
Well, thank you so much. You know, I really want to thank Tattered Cover for hosting tonight. Tattered Cover is just a legendary bookstore, and I wish I had a place like this close to me. I'm going on this tour. I'm working my way east across America, which is, you know, the most exciting experience that I can possibly imagine. And one of the things you notice is that there is this chain of independent bookstores that all know each other. You know, I've been instructed to pass on the love from, you know, from Green Apple Books and from King's English and from all of this chain, you know, that one by one in all of the big cities of America, there'll be at least one great independent bookstore. And it's so important. You know, that's really where literature lives. And, you know, when you have a bookstore like this, it's incredibly lucky. So thank you very much for hosting, and thank you all very much for coming out this evening. I do think that when a bunch of people are gathered together to talk about books of an evening, it means that the bad guys haven't won yet. So you know, give yourselves a round of applause. That's great. Yeah, I'm touring America. I still have to pinch myself. You know, it's such an incredible country. I do great events back home. There's some great readers back in Britain. It's a country that I love very much. You know, it's my home, and it's my home out of choice. And yet, when you do an event there, you ask for questions at the end, and everyone will stand at the back and look at their shoes. You know, and whereas I've been doing these great events. In the last sort of five or six cities I've been to, and you speak, and at the end, people are right up there with their questions. It's an open, it's a direct culture, and it's so much fun to do. And as a writer, I spend most of my year in isolation. Right? So you can imagine it's great fun when they let me out blinking into the sunlight, you know. And you know, I have to reinvent myself each time. How do these legs work? How do I smile? I work in a shed. I work in a shed that I had built and partly built myself at the end of the garden. And whatever you think of my writing, I'm a much better writer than I am a shed builder. It leaks, you know. When it rains, the water comes through the roof and I have to have this plastic bag over my computer. You know, so it's great to be here. You know. About 3 years ago, I wrote a book called Little Bee. Now, the reason I wrote it, it's a story about refugees, right? It's a story about the 5 billion people on Earth who are in a lot of trouble, and the 1 billion people on Earth who are us, right? We are the people who, when we turn the water on, you know, when we turn a tap, we can reasonably expect fresh drinking water to come out of it, right? Even if we don't have a job at the moment, well, we have the right to work for the most part. Even if we don't own a passport, well, if we applied for one, it would probably be granted as an application, and we could travel wherever we liked. Well, that isn't actually true for most of the world, right? We live in a kind of bubble. This is how I discovered that for the first time. When I was about 22 years old, I was at university and I was doing summer jobs. What they would do, they would give us a muster point to meet at. And we would go and we would get into a minibus and we would travel to wherever we were working that day. Now, we'd been doing some agricultural jobs, some construction site work, working in kitchens, any old job to pay the rent. Now, this one day, they put us into a minibus, and we're really young. We're just, you know, we're 22. They drive us out through the Oxfordshire countryside, and you've got to imagine the scene. It was beautiful, sunny, early morning with mist rolling along the fields. It was absolutely gorgeous. And we're in a holiday mood. It's the summer. You know, we think we're going to be working in the fields. It's very good. And then suddenly, they drive us through a perimeter fence, right, with razor wire on the top. And then they drive us through another and another into this very secure compound where there are these low grey buildings that are obviously very secured. And it's a kind of prison. And the kind of prison it was an immigration detention centre. The very first one that was ever purposed in the UK. It was called Campsfield House. And it turned out that what we did there was detain refugees. Now, a refugee, an asylum seeker in the United Kingdom, is someone who's come from a, you know, some horrific thing that has happened to them, and they've fled to the UK where they have a right to claim political asylum. We've signed a convention, a 1951 UN Convention on Refugees, which gives asylum seekers the right to say, look, I'm here, I've managed to escape, please help me while I get back on my feet. It's their right to do this. But about a dozen years ago, instead of helping them, we started detaining them in these places arbitrarily and for an indefinite period. This was a shock to me because I had found it out accidentally. I didn't know we did this. I was working in the kitchens, it turns out, and I worked for 3 days, chopping food up, boiling food up, mashing it and serving it, right, to refugees. So from Rwanda, from Botswana, from Sierra Leone, from Nigeria, from the conflict that was raging at that time in the Balkans. And I got talking to some of these people, and in my naive way, asking them questions like, what have you done wrong? You know, why are you locked up? And, you know, in, you know, we found a way of talking, you know, sometimes in English, sometimes in French, but haltingly, and we managed to communicate. And eventually, you know, finally the penny dropped for me that these guys hadn't done anything wrong. And this was an extrajudicial track. And this is something that we had decided arbitrarily to do with these people who had committed no crime. And they were largely defenseless to fight that. They didn't really have any representation. They didn't know that what was being done to them was just plain wrong. And nor did anyone else. You know, the existence of these facilities in this country too is largely unknown to people. So I wanted to write a story about it because that's what I do. So when it came time to write this story, I did some research. I did a couple of years of research. I talked to a lot of refugees. I talked to people who work with refugees who want them to be treated better. And I spoke with a bunch of people within UK government agencies that look after refugees as best they're able. I did a lot of book work. And I suddenly realised that, yes, this is a really big story. This happens to a lot of people. So I really wanted to write it up. Now, what I do as a writer, I have this three-part rule for myself, right? The first thing I do is I go out and I try to find whatever I think is the biggest story in town. Because why would you write about anything else, right? What's the biggest story? And for me, the biggest story is that we live in a very unequal world, right? We live in a bubble. It's weird how much of a bubble we live in when you look at the baseline of what most people are living in. The biggest story on Earth is the fact that we are just incredibly lucky and a lot of people are incredibly unlucky. Biggest story on Earth. Second thing is I try to tell that from the most unusual angle. Now, these stories about refugees are often in the news, you know. None of us are under any illusions about the existence of inequality in the world, but sometimes it's so big that we can't see it. And I think that a novel is the most sophisticated instrument that humans have so far developed for making a really big story small enough to see, if you can tell it from an unusual angle and make people see it again. Right? So the biggest story in town from the most unusual angle. Third part of my mission, for the most intelligent, smartest readers. Right? This is the great thing you can do when you're writing novels. Right? You can write up to your readers. Right? My readers are smarter than me. This is proved every day. I get a lot of email. Right? Right, on page 212, when you said this, you meant that. And I'm like, oh yes, probably did. You're right, thank you. You know, that's the kind of readers I have, and I'm really grateful to them because it keeps me honest as a writer. And it means that you can write up. You know, it means you can offer time to your readers in hideous fragments. I don't tell linear stories. I start in the middle. I take a moment of time and zip round to the other side of it, you know, so that it can be examined from backwards and from upside down. And if I find a moment in the story beautiful, I reserve the right to make a huge loop around it, you know, to digress terribly, to put the blocks of time back together in a way that the story has an emotional drive and an emotional narrative that feels linear. Because when you go into the world of a novel, time is not important. You know, what's important is these beats of the human heart that take you towards the end of the story. And if you've got smart readers, they'll let you do that. If you've got smart readers, they'll let you juxtapose moments of comedy with moments of horror. And they'll know that you're not laughing at horror. They'll know that you can put these two things together, you know, darkness and light, for their mutual amplification. That's what you can do if you write, you know, what we call literary fiction. It means that your readers are smarter than you. Thank the Lord. So, the biggest story in town, from the most unusual angle, for the most adventurous readers. That's what I do. And so when I settled on this theme of writing about refugees, that's what I wanted to do. So what is the angle that you choose? Now, this was a tricky bit, you know. When you're talking about refugees, you have people who are on both sides of this invisible barrier between what we call the developed world and what we call the developing world. That barrier looks very different depending on which side of it you're on. I tried and tried and tried, and I could not find one perspective from which to narrate this story. There is no godlike perspective on a story like this. You have to get down and dirty into the details of it, into the minds of the people involved. So in the end, I settled on this twin narrative. Little B is a character from Nigeria. She's 14 years old. She's a refugee. And we see our culture, our Western culture, through her eyes. And she seems to us almost as if she's landed from space. Right? She sees us, and we see ourselves through her eyes in the most unusual way. On the other hand, we have a character called Sarah, who befriends Little B after an incident that joins them both irrevocably for life that happens on an African beach. Well, Sarah is a woman who's in her 30s. She has a successful career in journalism. She lives in London. She's a very different character, and she sees that invisible barrier between the two worlds we live in from the other side. So you have this two perspectives. So I have my theme, which is refugees. I have my angle to tell it from, which is a twin angle. I have my event that brings these two worlds together. And this is all I'm ever trying to do in my book. I'm trying to say, well, what if the abstract was real? You know, what if this big intellectual idea that we have about refugees and about justice and about human rights, well, what if it actually happened to you one day? You're walking down a beach and suddenly you are met by someone who's fleeing for their life. Will you help them or not? You know, that's the propulsive event that kicks off the story. But then you have this other problem, and this is a problem that all novelists have, which is, given that these two characters have met each other, how do you keep them together for long enough for something to happen, you know, emotionally, that's true? This is the problem in every novel, and you look at every good novel and you can kind of lift up the hood and tinker around a bit and see how the novelists have solved it. For example, if you look at the... every novel needs a containment device, something to keep the action together. If you look at the novelists, say, of England, who are writing in the 18th and 19th centuries, and the 20th century almost, the thing that keeps the characters together in the action, that holds them inside the pages of the novel, the thing that makes them resolve their differences with each other instead of simply dispersing and walking out into the more general population, is social convention. And that's why when you read the great novels from England, you're continually asking yourself, well, if he's so awful, why don't you just leave your husband? No, why don't you just leave him? But of course, they can't, because social convention keeps them together. In a world where it was unthinkable to leave a loveless marriage, or it was unthinkable to have a child outside wedlock. You know, social convention keeps those novels together. Or if you look at one of the great American novelists, let's take Steinbeck, right, and take Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, close to my heart. It's a refugee novel, right? It's you have these a family of characters who are fleeing from the Dust Bowl, right? And the only place that they can go is west. As far as they can go is California. They can't go any further because there's sea. They can't leave the route from one side to the other because there's nothing there. So the novel has a natural containment, right? It has a start point. It has an end point. And it has no way for the characters to leave the action until they've traced this emotional story all the way through to the end. But I've got a refugee novel that I want to tell. You know, it's a story about refugees. And I don't live in a world where social convention will hold the characters together, because people just do what they want now, and good on them. And I don't have a containment device like Steinbeck had, because the world is completely open now and these characters can go anywhere. So what unlocked the novel for me is this containment device that I found, who's the real star of the novel. And in my opinion, the star of the novel isn't Little B, and it isn't Sarah. It isn't either of those twin narrators. Actually, it's a little kid who goes by the name of Batman, right? Now, there's kids in all of my writing. I didn't really work out why, but I kind of afterwards have worked out why. You know, the child in writing is my containment device, right? The child is the reason that Sarah and Little B don't just disappear and go their separate ways. The child is the reason that the novel holds together. It's the reason that they care, because they both love this little kid who calls himself Batman. Now, Batman was a pretty easy character to write, I have to admit. He was based on our own kid, who was 3.5 years old at the time that I was writing the book. And he would answer only to the name of Batman. We had 3 Batman costumes. We had one that was on him, one that was in the washing machine, and one that was ready to go on him. And he would stand around all day, you know, giving stern expressions, thus fighting crime in his hood and his cape. And he only answered to Batman. He lived in that world utterly, and I just took dictation. Easiest writing job I've ever done. Right? I just wrote him down, and he became the emotional glue that kept the book together. And it's indicative of so many things, having a child in the book. It's not just a child, it's a child who's experimenting with his identity in the world. He wears the hood and the mask. He's a child, but he's not a child. He wants to grow up, but in a particular way. And he's doing what all of us do at various points in our lives. We put on a different identity and try it for size. You know, all of us do it to a certain extent every single day. Maybe a little bit less as we get older. Right? In my case, I should probably really stop doing it. I should probably stop dressing up. But the that's why I have a child in it. He's the glue of the novel. And he's also very symbolic of these layers of identity that you can put on or take away. Because when you're talking about a refugee story, when you're talking about people moving from one culture to another, it's no more, no less than identities that people are capable of assuming and allowed to assume by the wider society. That's why Charlie's in the book. And kids are a really good reason to care. You know, there was a child in my last book, you know, very central to my first novel, Incendiary. Every week at the moment, I'm writing a column about children, you know, for the Guardian newspaper. And the reason I do that is exactly the same reason that I write novels. You know, it's because I think they're a really good reason to care. It's the only reason I've found to care so far. You know, a lot of people think this. You know, I'm not the first person who invented this. Kids. I'll tell you a story about mine. This happened just before I came out here. We've had the coldest winter that we've ever had in the United Kingdom in 50 years. There was a foot of snow on the ground. This is like a week before I came out here. And I saw this kind of bump under the snow in our backyard. And I hadn't seen our three-year-old for quite some time. So I thought it might be worth checking. You know, the kid does like to burrow. So I went out. And I had a look, dug in the snow, and I brought out what I can only describe as a space rocket. Right? It was a lemonade bottle that had been crudely hacked off. You know, the actual pouring part of the bottle had been hacked off by our six-year-old with his safety scissors. And it had been covered in aluminium kitchen foil. You know the stuff? Shiny stuff. Sellotaped on. You know, it really looked like a proper body of a rocket. And they'd constructed a primitive nose cone out of cardboard, which had been sellotaped onto the thing, which our three-year-old had painted with his fingers and some really sticky red paint, which explained something that had happened upstairs in one of the walls as well. You piece these things together afterwards, almost forensically. Right? So I'm curious by this stage, and the thing has some heft to it, right? It's rattling. So I take the lid off, and inside, there are these two alien eggs. Now, these are big. They're yay big, about the size of a grapefruit. Acrylic, clear acrylic. And inside, in this kind of green, translucent goo, these rubber alien fetuses are floating. And they're the most gross things you can ever imagine. They're absolutely hauntingly horrible, with their little alien eyes and their little waggly alien hands. Right? We thought they're absolutely gross, which is why I'm sure Santa Claus gave them to our children for Christmas. Right? Because Santa Claus knows that our kids really love everything that's gross. And for example, another thing that Santa Claus gave our kids was these two little tubs of stuff called snotty slime. They loved it. But these eggs were a completely different story. The kids were totally freaked out by them. And rather than loving them, they were the subject of worried, whispered conversations between our two boys, between the six-year-old and the three-year-old. They just gave a lot of looks and, you know, little chats about these things that we weren't privy to. And then slowly, after a few days, these alien eggs had just disappeared from our lives. And my wife and I thought nothing more of it. Calm was restored. The children seemed very happy. They'd just gone, presumably, to the void where all toys go. And our house were never quite sure. And, so it turns out that what had happened is that they're smart kids. You know, they've studied eggs at school. And they know what happens to an egg, right? An egg hatches. This idea had terrified them. Right? An alien egg becomes an alien, right? And the worst possible thing you can do is incubate it. Right? So central heating is the worst thing that you could possibly leave it in. So at the very least, they'd done the smart thing and moved them out into the snow. That was going to halt the process. But they'd gone one step further. Right? They had, you know, completely in secret, built this rocket for them. Right? And the reason I know that they hadn't just put it in the rocket symbolically, but that they actually believed that it was going to go up into space and take these aliens out of our lives, was because of a note that I found from our six-year-old, like, written in his own fair hand, which is very wonky. It's nascent writing, you know, that you have to decipher the spelling a little bit. But this is what the note said. It said, "Dear aliens, we are very sorry that you cannot live with us here on Earth. But we do hope that you will be happy on your own planet, Mars." That was it. Which leaves you with a dilemma as a parent. Because, you know, Santa Claus had seen fit to bring these things into the children's lives, and the kids had seen fit to divest themselves of the alien eggs. What can you do? Well, we had two choices. The first thing we could do was fess up to the kids that these alien eggs were actually made in China and presented no risk to human life and were unlikely to hatch. But, you know, where does that end? You know, what else do you have to explain? What other beautiful things do you have to make dull again if you go down that route? So what we did, of course, was we humanely disposed of the alien eggs in the rocket and it got them out of sight. We have this stuff called methylated spirits, which is a kind of industrial alcohol for cleaning, you know. We poured a little circle of that onto the lawn in our yard and we lit it, you know, and scorched a patch of the soil. And when the kids woke up the next morning, my wife and I were able to inform them that we'd heard a loud roar and a whooshing sound in the middle of the night. And we'd looked out and we'd seen a column of fire ascending to the stars. And did the children know anything about this? And they stood there and they were like, mm-hmm. They feigned total ignorance so brilliantly well, even the three-year-old, you know. Kids, you know. They're a reason to care. And they, in very young children, there's a way of seeing the world which is so beautiful and so true, right, that they don't need to grow up. And when you're in charge of helping a child to grow up, you don't want to do it too quick, right? And that's why in all of my work, you know, fiction, non-fiction, whatever it does, there always seems to be a kid lurking in there somewhere, you know. It's the opposite of a memento mori, you know. In the old paintings, you know, from the 16th century or whatever, you would always have a skull. A skull on the desk, a skull on the ground, you know. Holbein's ambassadors with a big skull, you know, this big sort of macho, you know, reminder that we're all going to die. And, you know, which on some levels is very beautiful, you know. I think, you know, carpe diem, seize the day, let's live each day as if it was our last, because it might well be. Let's remember that however grand we are, whatever big sort of ambassadorial costumes we have, we're all going to end up as dust. Here's the skull to remind you. Well, I do the opposite. You know, here's the child. You know, here's the child to remind us that we are on some level eternally alive and everything is important. You know, there's a reason that we should care about things like human rights. There's a reason we should care about refugees. There's a reason that we care about justice. And it's because there is a new generation and it's more beautiful than we are, you know. And it will perpetually renew itself and perpetually be more beautiful than we are. And our legacy to that growing generation should be one of justice. So there's always, you know, in my books, this opposition, this dramatic tension between the horrors of the world and the beauty of it. I put them as close together as possible for their mutual amplification. I'm going to read to you from the book, actually. You'd have thought I'd have brought a copy of the book to my reading, but I'm not that organised. So here one is. This is the voice of Little B. This is how she starts off the book. Most days, I wish I was a British pound coin instead of an African girl. Everyone would be pleased to see me coming. Maybe I would visit with you for the weekend. And then suddenly, because I'm fickle like that, I would visit with the man from the corner shop instead. But you would not be sad, because you would be eating a cinnamon bun or drinking a cold Coca-Cola from the can, and you would never think of me again. We would be happy, like lovers who met on holiday and forgot each other's names. A pound coin can go wherever it thinks it will be safest. It can cross deserts and oceans and leave the sound of gunfire and the bitter smell of burning thatch behind. When it feels warm and secure, it will turn around and smile at you, the way my big sister Nikki Ruka used to smile at the men in our village in the short summer after she was a girl, but before she was really a woman, and certainly before the evening my mother took her to a quiet place for a serious talk. Of course, a pound coin can be serious too. It can disguise itself as power or property, and there's nothing more serious when you are a girl who has neither. You must try to catch the pound and trap it in your pocket so that it cannot reach a safe country unless it takes you with it. But a pound has all the tricks of a sorcerer. When pursued, I have seen it shed its tail like a lizard so that you are left holding only pence. And when you finally go to seize it, the British pound can perform the greatest magic of all. And this is to transform itself into not one, but two identical green American dollar bills. Your fingers will close on empty air, I'm telling you. How I would love to be a British pound. A pound is free to travel to safety, and we are free to watch it go. This is the human triumph. This is called globalization. A girl like me gets stopped at immigration, but a pound can leap the turnstiles and dodge the tackles of those big men with their uniform caps and jump straight into a waiting airport taxi. Where to, sir? Western civilization, my good man, and make it snappy. Well, you see how nicely a British pound coin talks. It speaks with the voice of Queen Elizabeth II of England. Her face is stamped upon it, and sometimes when I look very closely, I can see her lips moving. I hold her up to my ear. What's she saying? Put me down this minute, young lady, or I shall call my guards. If the Queen spoke to you in such a voice, do you suppose it would be possible to disobey? I have read that the people around her, even kings and prime ministers, they find their bodies responding to her orders before their brains can even think why not. Let me tell you, it's not the crown and the scepter that have this effect. Me, I could pin a tiara on my short fuzzy hair, and I could hold up a scepter in one hand, like this, and police officers would still walk up to me in their big shoes and they'd say, "Love the ensemble, madam. Now, let's have a quick look at your ID, shall we?" No, it's not the Queen's crown and scepter that rule in your land. It is her grammar and her voice. That is why it's desirable to speak the way she does. That way, you can say to police officers, in a voice as clear as the Cullinan diamond, "My goodness, how dare you!" I am only alive because I learned the Queen's English. Maybe you're thinking, that isn't so hard. After all, English is the official language of my country, Nigeria. Yes, but the trouble is that back home we speak it so much better than you. To talk the Queen's English, I had to forget all the best tricks of my mother tongue. For example, the Queen could never say, "There was plenty wahala. That girl done use her bottom power to engage my number one son, and anyone could see she would end in the bad bush." Instead, the Queen must say, "My late daughter-in-law used her feminine charms to become engaged to my heir, and one might have foreseen that it wouldn't end well." It's all a little sad, don't you think? Learning the Queen's English is like scrubbing off the bright red varnish from your toenails the morning after a dance. It takes a long time, and there is always a little bit left at the end, a stain of red along the growing edges to remind you of the good time you had. So, you can see that learning came slowly to me. On the other hand, I had plenty of time. I learned your language in an immigration detention centre in Essex, in the southeastern part of the United Kingdom. 2 years they locked me up in there, and time was all I had. But why did I go to all the trouble? Well, it's because of what some of the older girls explained to me. To survive, you must look good or talk even better. The plain ones and the silent ones, it seems their paperwork is never in order. You say they get repatriated. We say sent home early. Like your country is a children's party, something too wonderful to last forever. But the pretty ones and the talkative ones, we are allowed to stay. In this way, your country becomes lively and more beautiful. I will tell you what happened when they let me out of the immigration detention centre. The detention officer put a voucher in my hand, a transport voucher, and he said I could telephone for a cab. I said, "Thank you, sir. May God move with grace in your life and bring joy into your heart and prosperity upon your loved ones." The officer pointed his eyes at the ceiling, like there was something very interesting up there, and he said, "Jesus." And then he pointed his finger down the corridor, and he said, "There is the telephone." So, I stood in the queue for the telephone. I was thinking, I went over the top with thanking that detention officer. The Queen would merely have said, "Thank you," and left it like that. Actually, the Queen would have told the detention officer to call for the damn taxi himself, or she would have him shot and his head separated from his body and displayed on the railings in front of the Tower of London. I was realising right there that it was one thing to learn the Queen's English from books and newspapers in my detention cell, and quite another to actually speak the language with the English. I was angry with myself. I was thinking, "You cannot afford to go around making mistakes like that, girl. If you talk like a savage who learned her English on the boat, the men are going to find you out and send you straight back home." That's what I was thinking. There were three girls in the queue in front of me. They let all us girls out on the same day. It was Friday. It was a bright sunny morning in May. The corridor was dirty, but it smelled clean. That is a good trick. Bleach is how they do that. That's Little Bee's voice. We've talked about how in a refugee story, when people transgress boundaries, you know, national, emotional, sexual, political boundaries, you need to tell that story from both sides. And so here's my other narrator. This is Sarah. The two stories weave together. They take alternate chapters, and slowly those two stories come together, and you work out what's happened, and you realize, are these two people going to be able to save each other? This is Sarah's voice, a completely different voice. Sarah starts chapter two of the book. From the spring of 2007 until the end of that long summer when little B came to live with us, my son removed his Batman costume only at bath times. I ordered a twin costume that I substituted while he splashed in the suds, so that at least I could wash the boy sweat and the grass stains out of the first. It was a dirty, green-kneed job fighting master criminals. If it wasn't Mr. Freeze with his dastardly ice ray, then it was the Penguin, Batman's deadly foe. Or the even more sinister Puffin, whose absolute wickedness the original creators of the Batman franchise had inexplicably failed to chronicle. My son and I lived with the consequences. A houseful of acolytes, henchmen and stooges, ogling us from behind the sofa, cackling darkly in the thin gap beside the bookcase, and generally bursting out at us willy-nilly. It was one shock after another, in fact. At 4 years old, asleep and awake, my son lived at constant readiness. There was no question of separating him from the demonic bat mask, the lycra suit, the glossy yellow utility belt, and the jet black cape. And there was no use addressing my son by his Christian name. He would only look behind him, cock his head, and shrug as if to say, "My bat senses can detect no boy of that name here, madam." The only name my son answered to that summer was Batman. Nor was there any point explaining to him that his father had died. My son didn't believe in the physical possibility of death. Death was something that could only occur if the evil schemes of the baddies were not constantly foiled. And that, of course, was unthinkable. That summer, the summer my husband died, we all had identities we were loath to let go of. My son had his Batman costume. I still used my husband's surname. And little B, though she was relatively safe with us, still clung to the name she had taken in a time of terror. We were exiles from reality that summer. We were refugees from ourselves. To flee from cruelty is the most natural thing in the world, of course. And the timing that brought us together that summer was so very cruel. Little B telephoned us on the morning they released her from the detention centre. My husband picked up her call. I only found out much later that it was her. Andrew never told me. Apparently, she let him know she was coming, but I don't suppose he felt up to seeing her face again. 5 days later, he killed himself by hanging. They found my husband with his feet treading empty air, touching the soil of no country. Death, of course, is a refuge. It's where you go when a new name or a mask and cape can no longer hide you from yourself. It's where you run to when none of the principalities of your conscience will grant you asylum. Little B knocked on my front door 5 days after my husband died, which was 10 days after they released her from the detention centre. After a journey of 5,000 miles and 2 years, she arrived just too late to find Andrew alive, but just in time for his funeral. "Hello, Sarah," she said. Little B arrived at 8 a.m., and the undertaker knocked at 10. Not 1 second too, or 1 second past. I imagine the undertaker had been silently standing outside our front door for several minutes, looking at his watch, waiting for our lives to converge onto the precise fault line at which our past could be cleaved from our future with 3 soft strikes of the bright brass knocker. My son opened the door and took in the undertaker's height, his impeccable tailoring, and his sober demeanour. I suppose the Undertaker looked for all the world like Batman's workaday alter ego. My son shouted along the hallway to me, "Mummy, it's Bruce Wayne!" Thanks very much indeed. I hope you enjoyed that, and I hope I've given you sort of an idea of the processes that led up to it. You know, imaginary story about something very real that's happening in the world, and that's just my angle on it. You know, you will all have your own angles on it, which are just as valid as mine. You know, as a writer, I'm always trying to start a conversation. You know, I think a book should be a starting point for a conversation between friends. You know, no writer should ever want to have the last word. Thank you very much. You've all been awesome. Thank you very much for coming out. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.